Property themselves running nothing. And most of the picture that we have of him as personality comes from what we get later. Now, in one of these dialogues, Plato shows Socrates reminiscing about an early interest that he had as a young man in what those Ionian philosophers were doing, in their theories of nature, like Anaximander and Xenocles. These are the words that Plato gives Socrates. Telling a friend, he says, when I was a young man, I was wonderfully keen on that wisdom which they call natural science. But I thought it splendid to know the cause of everything, why it comes to be, why it perishes, why it is. But he goes on to say, I became convinced that I have no natural aptitude for that kind of investigation. So in his youth, he was enthusiastic about inquiry and nature, causes, and then he decided that it wasn't for him. He had to take a different path. And elsewhere, he explains what it is that made him change his mind, his life direction in this way. The background of this is you probably know something about the oracle at Delphi, the great work of this oracle house in Greece. According to legend, there were words inscribed in stone over the door that led into this oracle. The words over the door read, "Know yourself." Now Socrates tells his friend, "I am not yet in a position to follow the Delphinian inscription and come to know myself. While I still lack this knowledge, it seems ridiculous to investigate irrelevant matters. So that is the reason I leave some subjects alone. And say this now, I conduct my researches not into them, into myself. I conduct my researches not into nature, not into the causes of why things come to be and why they perish. All my research, he says, conduct upon myself. I ask about myself. To try to pursue that Delphinian injunction, know yourself." He doesn't feel competent to know nature until he knows himself. So for Socrates, all knowledge, even knowledge of the arche and the origin of the cosmos, begins in something unexamined by. Examining himself, convinced Socrates of one thing, he knows nothing about superior things like anything. The only thing he's sure of is that he is not God, though he was very much like him. Others have the reputation of him. They claim to know many things. And Socrates found such people interesting, trying to speak to them, question them about what they know. In every case, he is disappointed. They are unable to explain what it is that they suppose to know. You cannot be wise about nature. Not just know information about nature, but to be wise in our knowledge. Without self, without being wise about ourselves, about how we live our lives. Because before knowledge can improve anything, you have to be able to use it well. It's not enough just to know. You have to be able to use knowledge well. And that requires something that science cannot explain. Socrates is saying that the source of wisdom lies in philosophical self-knowledge. That means knowledge about good, about human excellence, about how to care for the soul. Socrates asks a friend, is there anything about which a man of even small intelligence would be more serious than this? For Socrates, this question, what is the way we ought to live? This question defines the difference between philosophy religion, poetry, everything. What is the way we ought to live? How can we best figure out this? The word philosophy comes from two Greek words, philo, meaning love, friend, and sophie, wisdom. A philosopher is a lover of wisdom. And that does not mean that a philosopher is wise. As we'll see later on, Socrates argues that he can only love what we lack. To be a lover of wisdom means precisely not to be wise. But the difference between a philosopher and a fool, because they're the same in lack of wisdom, the difference between a philosopher and a fool is that a philosopher knows he's not wise. Whereas a fool, like you, doesn't know that. A philosopher knows he's not wise, but longs for wisdom and pursues it like a lover. Only a god is complete, perfect wisdom is not for mortals. Still, we can make ourselves relatively god with the right sort of effort. That's the goal of Socrates. You see then that Socrates learned from Pythagoras to talk about this now. Socrates learned from Pythagoras. A human soul is not just the life of a human body. It's a being in its own right, paradoxically affiliated with the body. That was the Pythagorean. We also see that he learned from Parmenides. We talked about this one night. He learned from Parmenides to explain the Pythagorean care for the soul in terms of cognition of truth and rational knowledge. There's something divine in this. We are not God. We are not mere beings. We are spiritual, demonic. Occupying an intermediate zone between the gods and the people. Unlike God, we don't possess perfect wisdom. But unlike animals, we can pursue it. To live philosophically, as Socrates understands it, is to live for reason in everything that you do. Nurture that divine part, suppressing the merely animal part. Nature. Practically every conversation that Socrates has with an interlocutor is very much like the one he has talked about at the very beginning. Socrates will ask someone some version of the question, what is X? Where X is society, and he asks euthyphro, love, beauty, or truth, or justice. To satisfy Socrates, an answer has to meet two conditions. It has to be true of all cases of that, true of all cases of society, and it has to give the reason why a thing belongs to that category, why something is an X, why a given act is a problem. So, for example, going back to that one that we talked about in the cloud. Answer Socrates, you from have to specify as you see both law and only private actions. Which also explains why just those acts and no others. You from fulfills the holy motives. His explanation, you remember he said, pious acts are those which are dear to all the gods. That explanation, it is true of all and only pious acts, satisfying that first condition. But he never explained exactly what it is about those acts that qualifies them as pious. To say that the pious is what all the gods love, that's not wrong. It's true that all and only pious acts satisfy that condition. Socrates wants the reason, the logos, to explain why a given act is loved by the world. by that last condition, you have to try to specify what scholars now call the platonic idea, the platonic form, two words used in like this change, idea form. You have to specify the platonic idea or form, i.e., whatever we want. The platonic idea or form of x is a form that all the particular x's share, in which it causes particular things to be x. Now this idea, this form, is an empty set. It's a form, a being, standing apart from material. If you accept Socrates' rule and play by his game, when he plays the what is x game with his interlocutors, if you accept his rule and agree to go along with him in his question, then you are assuming, even though the interlocutors aren't always clear about it, you're assuming that there's more to the world than material form. But there's more than just the physical. There are also entities of an entirely different sort. They're not physical. They're not material. They're not bodies that occupy space or time. They cannot be sensed with the eye, or smelled with the nose. They can only be grasped intellectually, understanding. These are the platonic ideas. Particular things. Anything you can see with your eyes, anything you can pick up, think is so real and so tangible. Those particular things are material bodies. Forms are images. Those particular things are known by experience, in the sense ideas are grasped with intellectual understanding. Those particular things come into existence and they undergo change. But the ideas are eternal. To know, to have knowledge in the strict and philosophical sense, is to know those ideas. And sense perception is simply worthless of that kind of knowledge. In the Apology, Plato gives us an account of the trial of Socrates. Had to undergo before the court of Athens. The charge that is brought against Socrates seems rather crudely put together. His offenses include taking money to teach people how to make weak arguments seem strong, and promoting the study of things in the sky and under the earth. But the most serious charge of all is the charge that Socrates corrupts the youth of the house, which he is said to have done by teaching against the city's god and promoting the worship of new god. That charge is a capital offense. Socrates is arguing for blood. According to ancient procedure, the charges would have been posted in the agora, the public marketplace, would have been posted in the agora some weeks or months in advance. There would have been a preliminary hearing before an official to determine the merit of the case. Having been found worthy, the case is now before the court. According to the traditional Athenian procedure, no case, however complex, is allowed to last more than a single day. Voting will immediately follow the speeches, with no deliberations, no possibility of appeal. The case is being heard by a jury of 501 male Athenian citizens. These jurors are called dikaios. But they were not just jurors, but really judge and jury combined. There is no judge as we understand. There's no official who instructs the dicast, and those dicasts have been selected at random from the eligible citizens. Not to keep guessing, Socrates is found guilty. although by a fairly narrow margin. He ascended death by poison. He will be required to drink a mortal dose of the deadly poison chemical. Usually, execution immediately follows after a capital conviction. But Socrates' trial came just a few days before the annual festival of Apollo on the nearby island of Delos, to which the Athenians had sent an important delegation. To keep the festival ritually pure, executions are suspended until the Athenian delegation returns. So Socrates lingered on in prison for 30 days. He was constantly kept in irons until the very last day. Visitors were allowed at any time, and indeed they were expected to come and bring him his meal. He was cheerful. So let's turn to the apology and take a look at the kind of defense Socrates offered against the charges. The very first thing he tells is that, contrary to the charge, he never takes money for his profit. He's available to anyone without fee. But he says, really, anyway, all this talk about instruction is irrelevant. I don't teach in any formal sense at all, he says. All I do is just show up and talk with whoever is around. I go to the agora. I go to the gym. I talk with whoever comes by. Start the conversation. He converses with people who claim to be wrong. Tries to get them to share their wisdom, as they never do, eventually giving up and as youth appropriate under his relentless pressure. Why does Socrates do that? Why go after people? Even if he privately thinks they're fools, why embarrass them? Socrates tells the jurors about a story. He tells them a story about his friend Chaerephon. Chaerephon didn't tell Socrates, but he had a plan. He wanted to do something. He'd been watching Socrates all over around talking with him. He thought to himself, Chaerephon thought to himself, Socrates is so wrong. But he never said that. He didn't tell Socrates. Instead, what he did is he went to Delphi and he put a question to the oracle. He asked the oracle at Delphi, is there anyone wiser than Socrates? The oracle comes back. No one is wiser than Socrates. So Chaerephon tells Socrates what happened. He tells Socrates about the flaw, the oracle. When Chaerephon tells Socrates that, Socrates is quite puzzled. Because he doesn't feel any wisdom. He thinks, well, maybe I'm wrong about him. Maybe I don't know what wisdom is, so of course I don't recognize him myself. And so he decides to set out to inquire. What is wisdom? First thing he does, he goes to all the important people, the important statesmen, the important generals, the important teachers who have a reputation for being wise, right? With constantly disappointed. Like Euthyphro, they're unable to explain what they supposedly know. So he tries to ask the poets. Then he finds that wisdom plays no role in the art of poetry, which is divinely inspired rather than knowledge and reason. Finally, he decides to ask the craftsmen. Artisans. Now, these people definitely do have a kind of knowledge. There's no doubt about it. Highly practical, effective knowledge, like knowing how to make a good pair of shoes, knowing how to navigate a ship across the Mediterranean. But it's not wisdom, not the right sort of knowledge to count as wisdom. Because these technicians, Socrates discovers, are incapable of explaining the reason why they do what they do. Yes, that shoemaker, he can make great shoes, but if you ask him, why like this, why like that, why this material, why this stitching, why do you do this first, why that, They just don't answer. They just know. They know how to do it. Don't give me these questions. I'm a doer and not a talker. Socrates also discovers that their art can be used for good or bad. You can make shoes for Winston Churchill. You can make shoes for Hitler. Whereas Socrates expects that wisdom should be a penetrating insight into the good. Now, all of this apparently fruitless inquiry leaves Socrates more puzzled than he was at the outset. How could the oracle influence his model? How could the oracle single him out for wisdom when it's obvious that he doesn't know anything? Now, the oracle at Delphi has a reputation for enigma. It can play with words. It can even be ironic. So you have to be careful how you interpret what it says. It occurs to Socrates that the oracle is mocking humanity with its answer to Chiron's question. The statement, "No one is wiser than Socrates,"
okay,
can mean that Socrates is the wisest person in the world. But it could also mean that no one is wise. No one at all. That there's just no wisdom among humanity. Because if Socrates is wise, and he only knows that he's not wise, then there's no hope. Two possibilities. Socrates tells us that he himself decided on a third interpretation of his opinion. He decides that the oracle means that he is the wisest precisely because he knows he's not wise. Now that doesn't mean that he has no knowledge, zero. That he's in a condition of sheer ignorance and yet somehow knows it. His claim is not to know anything fine and good. He knows nothing fine and good in the way that an expert knows, say, how to make a good pair of shoes, how to navigate through the Mediterranean storm. He possesses no expertise in the best way to live. Life, wisdom, goodness, these Socrates are problems, not things that he knows. The oracle, which all the Greeks understood to be the voice of the god Apollo, this oracle, in saying Socrates is wisest of all, it seems to be sending a message to Socrates, a message coming from the gods. He's being called out. Some form of divine service. What did the oracle at Delphi command? Know yourself. And most people do not. They think they're wrong. Socrates' task must be to reveal how mistaken people are to think they're wrong. And that becomes his mission in life. To be relentless in his own self-examination, and to be a gadfly, confronting them with the evidence of advantage, stinging the frog, to stimulate them to take better care of the soul. Ignorance, mere ignorance, need not be blamed. What's bad is to believe that you know what you do not. And worse is to claim to have the right to speak in the name of God, to tell others to shut up and listen because you know what you know. That's the worst of all. Socrates is convinced of his divine power. So much so that he tells these jurors that even if they were to release him from these charges, on the single condition that he give up these pesky inquiries, he says, he will not do it. tells the jurors, I will obey the God rather than you. And as long as I draw breath and am able, I shall not cease to practice law. Well, that's stirring stuff. How can we not see a hero in suffering? Plato does all he can as a writer to give us the impression of a high-minded philosopher who was convicted by the stupidity of the law. Think about his defense. Think about what he's really telling those 500 randomly chosen Athenian citizens. What is he saying to these dodgehams, Spartans, Democrats, one and all? He does not say what he does not say. He doesn't say, I'm a citizen of this democracy too, just like you. I have a right of free speech. I have a democratic right to say and think what I choose and do not. Instead, he argues that his behavior is not subversive at all, contrary to their belief. He says that they're wrong to think that he harms the city. He claims that all of his actions are divinely sanctified. He's following a God and not a democratic consensus. He's aligning himself with the gods and not. In other words, in fact, what he's telling them is, you're wrong and I'm right. You don't understand anything and I am wrong. He prefers his conscience over their democracy. The authority of his conscience over their democratic end of this whole course, looking ahead, end of the term, you will read a work by Nietzsche, German philosopher, 19th century. And in this work that we'll read, the very beginning of it, has a small chapter called The Problem of Socrates. Nietzsche calls Socrates the most questionable phenomenon of antiquity. What is so questionable, so problematic about Socrates? It's that idea of a new and unheard of esteem and knowledge in insight. What Nietzsche means is that the man will reason. Anything worthwhile has to be reasoned out, consciously understood, made explicit, and examined, because we know, as often we tell those jurors, unexamined life not worth. Think about that. I mean, we repeat it now. Please say, yeah, good old Socrates. I'm in the universe. Unexamined, I'm going to 4 years of examining life. Think what it really means to say an unexamined life is not worth living. That means a life without philosophy, right at the center, not TV. You might as well just go. You might as well be a dog looking for something in your mouth. A life spent, this is what he's telling you, a life spent in pursuit of anything other than wisdom is unworthy. Now, what is it in wisdom? You know, that's great. What is it that makes wisdom so good? All the other goods, anything you can think of, wealth, health, justice, they're not always good. You have to know how to use them with. That's wisdom. Wisdom is the knowledge that makes all the other goods good. Wisdom, therefore, includes all the other virtues. You're not fully virtuous until you're wise, and if you're wise, your virtue and your happiness will be. Now, you might think, if Socrates really cares as much as about the Athenians, about the well-being of the citizens. I urge them to care for themselves and their souls, put the most important things first in their lives. He really has all this attitude, and it's, you know, it is, after all, a democracy. All the major decisions are made right there in public, in big public debate. You'd think he would be there in those debates, you know, trying to make sure, help the citizens make the right decisions. Never done this. Never. Now he explains why. The thing is, when he tells the jurors, it's strange, he says that he hears voices. He has, all his life, ever since childhood, he's heard a voice. Now this voice never tells him what to do. He only speaks against things that he was considering. It only turns him away from certain things that he was considering. This voice turned him away from home. At some point, he must be asking himself, shouldn't they go to the assembly? Think they might make the wrong decision? Maybe I should talk. Tells the jurors, that was wise, because he says to the jurors that he is too honest to survive if I occupy myself with office. See again how he's, you know, he's being very pervading in the speech of the jurors, but he's really pointing something. He says that I am too honest to survive in democratic office. In other words, the only way you can survive in a democracy is by being dishonest. He's in effect telling all those Democrats, all 501 of them, he's saying, you're all corrupt. I'm the only one with an honest soul. He says, you cannot serve both justice and state. These are his words, his apology. A man who really fights for justice must be a private, not a public one. His duty is to survive. Tells those jurors that in the lead up to today's proceedings, when he had to think about what am I going to do? Should I defend myself? Throw myself on the roof to the court? What should I do? Bring my wife and crying children in before them? That was a thing. Thinking about what to do, never did the voice intercede to dissuade him from the course of the which is to deny the charges, to make no melodramatic display with his wife and his children, to defend himself bravely, audaciously, from conviction before the jurors. When he thought about the possibility of fleeing Athens and living somewhere in exile, which is what all his friends hoped that he would do, he knew from that inner voice that it was the wrong decision. So he says to himself, that must mean that what's happening to me now, he says this in the last part of the apology, after the jurors have made their decision, and they've come back now, verdict of guilty, and then they made their decision about the penalty, which has come back now, and shall be dead. So now he's receiving from them a death penalty. But he says, no, this voice, it always dissuaded me from a wrong thing. And it didn't dissuade me from everything that I've done here before you this afternoon. And the result of those actions of mine have been that I am sentenced to die. So what would you really infer? Maybe death is not a bad thing. Now, of course, all people think that not only death is a bad thing, it's the worst thing. But think about that for a moment. Those are the same people who think they're the same people, like Euthyphro, who are convinced that they know. And it takes Socrates just a few minutes on the street corner to tie them up into confusion and show that they don't know anything. So why is the fact that the law happens to say yes or no? Why is that? And so when he receives his sentence of death from the court, Socrates says, doesn't reduce him. He says to the jurors, you think you pardon me, but he tells them, you too must be of good heart as regards death, gentlemen. And keep this one truth in mind. What he's telling you now, having just killed him, he says, keep this one truth in mind that a good man cannot be harmed. A good man cannot be harmed. Everything you do to me, thinking that you harm me, harms you much more than it harms me. On Monday, we're going to follow this story about the last day of the song. We're going to pick up the story in the dialogue of Cain, which tells about the very last day of Socrates' life on earth. The last day in that prison, he meets with his friend, his dad, about the whole month. Socrates, just another day. And the fact that he will die at the end of this day doesn't have any question. If you look on the cover of your course pack, you'll see a rather romantic depiction of his last event, the very last moment of Socrates' life. You see him in prison, looking cheerful and strong, surrounded by his friends and disciples who are hardly able to control their with one hand, he grasps the cup of gold and the hemlock, and the other hand, he points to the reality and convinces him of something higher. Throughout that dialogue, maybe he'll be trying to persuade his broken friends. They're wrong to note that he's right to point to something higher. I have time. Let me ask you to please not start getting annoyed. Let me see if there's anything I can say, questions, comments, anything that you'd like to ask about the apology, Socrates, or other topics. My understanding is that those are the only two. Yeah, that's the translations. I have a choice when I prepare material for the class. Either I can get you the very latest, most up to date, and scholarly exact translations, in which case our form pack would be about 100. Or I can get the old public domain translations, which are not wrong, and they're not bad, but they're about a century old, and they were created, the ones that you have, by a man named Benjamin Gallic, who's a famous scholar at Oxford for many years. And for better or for worse, he was a Christian, and that comes through in places. So he, for example, talks about God in the same way. It's not a bad translation. It's just not the very absolute latest, scholarly, most exact translation.
Really, it's perfect. Was Socrates like against the idea of democracy?
Against the idea of democracy?
Democracy?
Well, we have to kind of try to put an answer together, because he doesn't come right out and tell us in explicit terms. But if we look at his attitude, I pointed out to you, I mean, he gives us lots of. You can't be an artist, you know, and really, you know, in your heart, like Barack Obama, really, you know, thinking that's the right way to organize society and respond to the Democrats the way you see it. It's like wrong, you know, telling you. Once the doors are closed and we're quiet, I'm just among my country club friends, I know that most people don't follow what I say. Now, in fact, Socrates would not be exceptional for this attitude. This attitude of being pretty skeptical about democracy tended to be the attitude among the intellectual elite in Athens. The Democrats were really, you know, they were the mob. There were democratic Athens divided up into approximately three groups. There were what was called the oligarchy. Those were the old established families that had been ruling Athens since they lived in the Democrats. And then there were the Democrats. The Democrats had recently had a big struggle with the oligarchy to establish democracy. There was a lot of tension. who ruled established families and the mass Democrats. And then there were the intellectuals, a few philosophers, some poets, teachers of rhetoric. They tended, for the most part, not without exception, for the most part, tended to be against democracy, but pretty much the same reason the Democrats or the intellectual people often have dealt with. It seems bad at touring politics. It seems bad at managing money. It seems fickle. You know, you don't, Socrates, in one place he says, you don't have a lottery to figure out who you're going to send to the Olympics for running a 50-meter dash. You pick the best one. So he says, how come in really important stuff, like decisions about Athens' foreign policy, or how to spend our capital, how come there we throw away that understanding and just decide what to do? So, yes, I think on balance, Socrates probably was skeptical. And then we'll see in Plato. Plato is beyond skeptical. Outright hostile.
Is it in the public that the time to go for property is the idea?
Yes, that's well said. That's just exactly what happened. If this were a perfect course, it might be meaning I could have it here all of you. Then it could mean a lot more to the public, and we could get into that very point, but we're not going to be able to get into that part. If we lead a little bit to the public, and it won't be able to
get into that part. Sure.
I think the reading mentions the number. I'm not sure about that. It was something I caught me by surprise. Something roughly like 230 to 280. Socrates does say it surprises me. I expect it to be even more. Yeah, I don't see anything else.